Hello and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about liberty, democracy, and pluralism in Afghanistan and around the world. I'm your host, Omar Sadr, Senior Research Scholar at the University of Pittsburgh. As in the previous episode, this episode centers around the certain normative and ethical dilemmas emerging from the conflict in the Middle East. Since October the 7th and the beginning of war in Israel and Palestine, a number of issues has come up to the forefront of public and political debate, or at least I can say there has been a normative debate on limits of three things: limits and merits of freedom of speech, particularly in academia and campuses in the United States, how we understand anti-Semitism, and finally, the divergence of views with respect to Israel-Palestine conflict. Some of these issues has been hotly debated to the extent that at least three prominent university presidents were grilled in a congressional committee in the United States Senate. I have a guest today who is a political scientist and a prominent expert on Afghanistan, Professor Barnett Rubin. He is a non-resident senior fellow at Quincy Institute Responsible Statecraft and at New York University Center on International Cooperation, where he was a senior fellow and director of Afghanistan Regional Program. For Barney, I'm glad to have you here on the podcast. Very welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Omar. It's good to see you, catch up with you.
Let me
start. First time I've seen you since you left Afghanistan, I believe.
Let me ask you the first question from the article that you wrote on responsible statecraft, where you say, if I quote, "Views on the Israel and Palestine conflict are polarized worldwide between those who have experienced the past few centuries as an East-West conflict and those who have experienced it as a North-South conflict." I think this is the crux of your argument. So tell us, what do you mean by that? So by that, you really say that this is you situate the conflict within a very broader context rather than the region. It has a political dimension, but also it has an ideological dimension. How do you bring all this set of very complex dimensions of the conflict together in this article?
First of all, I wrote that article in the immediate aftermath of Hamas's attack on Israel and massacre of about 1,200 people, and before Israel had started its offensive in reprisal. Since that time, of course, since I wrote that article, Israel has killed approximately 20,000 people in Gaza, wounded about 50,000. There are reliable reports that at the highest level of the Israeli government, they're discussing expelling the entire population of Gaza to Egypt. And the result of this is, I think, that the political situation globally about this conflict is no longer exactly as I put it in that article. That is, it is less polarized, because if you look at the recent UN General Assembly resolution calling for supporting the self-determination of the Palestinian people, there were only four countries that voted against it: the United States, Israel, and two tiny South Pacific islands. So that has changed. However, let's go back a little bit and see, you know, the today, before we turned on the camera, we were discussing the situation in the world today, you know, that besides Afghanistan, Ukraine, Israel, Palestine. What is interesting, and not that many people have remarked on, is that there is a very close link between the conflict in Ukraine and the establishment of the State of Israel. The president of Ukraine is Jewish. At one time, what is today Ukraine was 10%, 20% Jewish population. Those people were wiped out by the Nazis. Many of the leaders of the Zionist movement of Israel came from Ukraine, as well as neighboring Poland and so on. Of course, later they were joined by all the Jews from the Arab world, as well as from Iran and so on. So looking back on that history, people who come out of that history look on it, on the, what is going on in Israel in that context, you know, the coming out of the situation of the Jews in Europe, their persecution, their attempt to find a solution, the feeling that they couldn't rely on anyone else, and their eventual success in founding their own state in Palestine, which they considered to be their historic homeland. Now, on the other side, and of course, Palestine is not just the historic homeland of the Jewish people from thousands of years ago. It's actually a real place, you know, where people have been living all those thousands of years, and a lot of things have happened in those thousands of years since the Roman Empire exiled the Jewish people from there. Of course, now most of the population, when the Zionists started their movement to establish a state in Palestine, most of the population was 96% Arab. At that time, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Zionists never would have succeeded in building a state there if the Ottoman Empire still existed. Now, why doesn't the Ottoman Empire still exist? Because it was destroyed by Great Britain as part of World War I. You know? And as part of that, of course, then afterward, Britain, France, and other Western powers redrew the map of the Middle East, and they turned it from an Islamic empire headed by a sultan who was also the caliph, Amir al-Mu'mineen, of Sunni Muslims anyway, into a set of very weak nation states, of weak legitimacy. Some, obviously, Egypt is a strong nation state. It has a history going back 5,000 years and so on. But many of the other countries, while they do have long-time histories, their histories do not coincide in any way with their current borders and populations. And that was the context, the British conquest or defeat and dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire was the context in which the British government agreed to support the creation of what they called a national home for the Jewish people, which meant that once Palestine came under the British mandate, which was just a new form of colonialism, you know, supervised by the League of Nations, it was actually supporting the immigration of Jews. Now, of course, the Zionists and the British later came into conflict quite a bit because the rapid immigration of Jews, especially after the rise of power of Hitler and the creation of a huge wave of Jewish refugees trying to find some place to go at a time when they were not permitted into the United States or Great Britain, you know, many other places where anti-Semitism was quite strong, if not in the same way as in Germany. That created more conflict with the local people who, of course, whatever their views about Jews, they didn't think that these foreigners should build a state in the land where they were living without consulting them. So in that respect, what Zionism, which appeared to Jews coming from Europe and to Westerners whose historic perspective is centered on Europe, World War II, Cold War, and so on, what appeared to them as a liberation movement appeared to the Palestinians and to the rest of the colonial world as a colonial movement.
There is a good distinction in your article, which is not published and it will be published very soon. You distinguish between original foundation of Zionism, what you have touched upon now as a liberation movement, and what came later on, and it was aligned with British colonialism. And for that, you discuss, for example, the publication of Der Neue Weg, The New Path, which happened after at the early 20th century, after 1903, 1905 pogroms, which happens in Russia. So the hatred against Jews was quite high across Europe, but and particularly Russian Empire at that point of time, Jews finally, particularly the new generation, realized that they have to come together and found some sort of liberation movement. And there was a political emancipation kind of political inspiration for this. So walk us through this journey where Zionism was founded as a liberation movement, an idealization of an independent state for Jewish people, which finally they should realize their self-determination. And then throughout the post-Second World War, it gradually transformed into something different.
Well, the trouble is, you see, the Jews living in this part of Eastern Europe, that was about half of the Jews in the world at that time were actually living in Tsarist Russia, which was much bigger than today's Russia. They did constitute a kind of a nation. You know, they had their own language and culture. They didn't speak the languages of the surrounding people, or they did, but to do commerce with them. Wasn't their language. They had their own separate religion. But of course, to have a state, they had no control over their security, right? So as political movements grew in the 19th century, some Jews thought democracy in which would grant Jews equality, which they'd never had, well, no one had had equality before, actually, would be the answer. Others thought, no, we need to be part of revolutionary movements. Remember, Karl Marx was Jewish, or of Jewish origin. And many of the leaders of the Russian Revolution were actually of Jewish origin, like Trotsky. But increasingly, it looked like they could, you know, by the 1930s, it was becoming the prediction that Zionism had made that there was no room for Jews anywhere in Europe with other people looked like it was coming true with the Holocaust and with the United States closing its doors to immigrants. In addition to which, even going further back, even at the time that you mentioned at the early origins of Zionism, on the one hand, there was a popular movement of Zionism, self-defense, you know, like the people who fought against the Nazis in the Warsaw Ghetto, many of them belonged to Zionist youth groups. But they weren't fighting against Palestinians in Palestine. They were fighting against the Nazis who were occupying Poland. And because the Zionism taught self-defense. So, but to actually exercise that in a sovereign way, they needed a territory. And who controlled territories at the late 19th century, early 20th century? The colonial powers. So the leader of the Zionist movement, he tried to negotiate with the Sultan, the Ottoman Sultan, and so he tried to persuade him to allow the Jews to establish a state. But of course, the Ottoman Sultan, like any other ruler.
But there were also alternative plans, Uganda or Egypt Sinai or Argentine.
Yes, because the Ottoman Empire was a big obstacle. So they tried, they explored all these others, but none of them worked out for more or less the same reasons. You know, there are people living everywhere. So in order to, so the logic of Jewish self-determination met the logic of needing to have a territory. And also there was this very strong Jewish religious historic attachment to this territory of Palestine, which they knew nothing about Palestine as it actually was. Their idea was about, you know, the Palestine they remembered from the Bible and history 2,000 years ago, which is not the Palestine that existed at this time. After all these centuries of Islam and colonialism and so on. So the leaders of Zionism started negotiating with the great powers, and they could see also they were, although they were oppressed in Europe, they were still Europeans. And they were had a certain European ideas, which was, you know, that they're civilized nations and they're backward nations. And they thought that the Jews deserved to attain their rightful status as one of the civilized nations of the world. You know, one of the developed nations. And therefore, they started negotiating with the colonial powers, especially with Britain, the major one, over finding a territory. And eventually, the logic of needing to have a territory overcame the logic of self-determination and self-liberation, which was the original motivation for the movement in Europe. Because in that territory, there were people already living who had their own aspirations. That was exactly the same time. The Zionism started at exactly the same time as Arab nationalism,
right,
under the Ottoman Empire. And on Arab nationalism, of course, Arab nationalism was largely invented by Christians who could not identify with the Islamic movements. But the combination of Arab nationalism and Islamic movements is still, you know, still is powerful and still, controversial and very complex. But so Israel, you know, so the Zionist movement succeeded in becoming State of Israel through the support that it had from Great Britain and then from the United States, and to some extent from France, so that it became, and saw itself, and it's still talking about itself as an extension of the West. You may have noted that President Netanyahu, as well as Defense Minister Gallant, have both tried to characterize the war in Gaza as a war between Western civilization and barbarism, or something like that, you know, which not many people have actually accepted that characterization. But that is partly a result of the history of the movement.
Definitely, there is continuous attempt to characterize the conflict and a kind of dualistic nature between evil and good, between civilized and uncivilized. And we can come to that, but you have also touched upon so many other issues that emergence of Arab nationalism and was parallel to emergence of Zionism in the region. And many scholars also argue how Arab nationalism, even the very first secular origin of it, had also seeds of anti-Semitism. In your paper, in your article, you quote Najib Zohri, who has been one of the prominent Lebanese Christian Arab nationalists. But apart from Najib Azouri that you have quoted, I think I don't know to what extent has ideas traveled across Arab regions, given the fact that he wrote his thesis and his book in a language that most of the Arabs were not speaking. It was not originally written in Arabic, but also he was not from mainstream.
It was written in French. He wrote in French.
Yes, it was in French. And then he was also a Christian. But many others also argue that the ideas that Najib proposed was not much intelligibly taught, and it was not transferable to a large extent understandable for the common people of Arab in that region. But there were other Arab nationalists at that point of time who really shifted the atmosphere of Arab nationalism at that point. And one is Salama Musa, and the other one is the Yemeni writer Sa'teh Hasri. So how do you see transformation of anti-Semitism from an European ideology, which was quite strong there in Europe rather than in Middle East, or transferring it to the Middle East, where a number of Arab secular, not Islamists, back then Islamists were not prominent in Arab region, who somehow internalized and tried to found Arab nationalism on one of these key pillars. Do you consider anti-Semitism as one of the pillars of early Arab nationalists?
No, I don't, but I'll tell you, here's the connection. See, as we've been discussing, early Arab nationalist ideologues were largely Christian. And as you mentioned, some of them, like Najib Azouri, they wrote in French. There was a big anti-Semitic incident in Damascus in the 1830s, where the Jews of Damascus were accused of using the blood of a Christian child for their religious rituals. But it came from the Christians in Damascus, not from the Muslims. See, and there is a very important Palestinian leader named Yusuf Zia, or Yusuf Zia al Khalidi, who is the great great granduncle of Rashid Khalidi, the historian, who wrote a letter to Theodor Herzl, the leader of Zionism, warning him about all the things that have happened since then if he went ahead with his plan for a Jewish state. And one of the things he mentioned is that there are among the Arabs, there are fanatical Christians who are against the Jews. You see, so I think anti-Semitism among the Arabs, or anti-Jewish feeling, of course, there were always religious friction among the different religious communities and so on, which went up and down over the centuries in different locations and so on. But as an organized ideology, it was part of the westernization of Arabs, as was nationalism. You see, and it's not a coincidence that this first tract of Arab nationalism, which was also anti-Semitic, actually, was written in French. Now, after the establishment of the State of Israel, it became different because I would define anti-Semitism as some kind of prejudice against or hatred of Jews based on nothing, but resentment of hatred of Jews and so on became much more widespread in the Muslim world and in the Arab world after the establishment of Israel.
Yeah.
And expulsion of 700,000 Arabs from the territory of Israel and the emergence of and the Jewish state going to war against many of the new Arab countries. So that feeling that opposition to Zionism, of course, sometimes the way average people think, or simple people, or the way politicians think, they don't make a distinction between someone's ideology and their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you are familiar with this in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
it's extremely common. You know, if they're against the ideology of a certain political party, they blame it on the ethnicity of the people who are leading that political party.
Yeah.
So, similarly, but it was based on something. In other words, you could say, what did the Jews do to the Germans? They did nothing to the Germans except make them richer, more cultured, and have better scientific research. But what did the Jews do to the Arabs? Well, they actually expelled, as an organized, not the Jews, but an organized Jewish political force, established a state on Arab territory and expelled hundreds of thousands. So there's a basis for this hostility, which some people elaborated into something beyond just that political conflict.
Yeah, but you give a definition of anti-Semitism as a simple hatred and prejudice against Jews. I recall reading Basim Tibi, who is a well-known Arab political scientist, and he uses Anna Arendt's definition of anti-Semitism, in which she distinguishes between Judophobia, which is, as you mentioned, sprinkles of it might exist in every community or religious group against the Jews. But most importantly, what we should understand is anti-Semitism is something beyond Judophobia, which is, for Ayn Rand, it's a genocidal ideology that you accuse Jews for a certain form of conspiracy that you may have, or as you said, hatred based on nothing. I want to have your opinion on how can we understand between Judophobia and anti-Semitism on one hand, but on the other hand, also something which is quite controversial. Do we have to distinguish between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism? These two are two different things. And how can we really think about these two different phenomenons or concepts correctly?
Well, you're quite right. I mean, the thing is, there have been, Jews were subject to various discrimination in all, especially in Christian lands, also to a lesser extent in Muslim countries, for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years. And mostly, that was, of course, the real basis for it was economic competition or struggle for power or something, but it was legitimized with reference to religion, which meant that basically a Jew who converted to Christianity or Islam was not subject to it anymore. Now, sometimes they still were, you know, but not in the same, like if Jews were expelled from a country, if they converted, they could stay there. Sometimes they were still persecuted. I won't go into the details here, but as part of the secularization of Europe, see again, the modernization, secularization of Europe, this religious-based Judophobia was developed into scientific race theory, which was also connected to colonialism, because it was not just aimed at Jews. It was part of a whole ideological system, which also justified the slavery of the enslavement of Africans, the inferiority of other races, and claimed that human beings were divided into different races. But according to the anti-Semitism, the Jews were not white or European. They were a unique race with this evil essence that was trying to take over the world. Now, of course, elements of this conspiracy theory, you know, you do hear, for instance, some statements by the Muslim Brotherhood echo some of this.
Yes.
Again, I would say that's part of the westernization of the Muslim world, because after all, the Muslim Brotherhood is something that was developed in the 20th century in reaction to modern politics in Egypt. It's not the time of Prophet Muhammad. Also, of course, much of the Muslim world was engaged in an anti-colonial struggle against Britain and France, who were fighting against Germany. So naturally, the people who were fighting against Britain and France gravitated to Germany, and they might have absorbed some of Germany's ideology. But I don't. But there is no sign of a really deep ideological basis for anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. It's an outgrowth of, you know, religious conflict over years and the current political conflict, which is then elaborated by some people by this very virulent, by the using this virulent ideology imported from Europe.
That's exactly true. I think I echo what you say. And Muslim Brotherhood, though it was founded in 1928, but later on it's Said Qutb, the main ideologue, who writes a book, Our Struggle with the Jews, in which he argues that Muslims should pay tribute to those Yorks who joined the war against the Jews, and there's a continuous war with, and the conflict is endless. And this is, he coins the term conflict of minds, Jang Afkar, what is translated in Farsi and Arabic, that because Jews back then, when he wrote the book, didn't have a state and the army. He said Jews, of course, don't have the army to fight the Muslims, but they fight with the ideas and ideologies, and hence the Muslims should be prepared to counter this. And there are many other episodes that you read, even followers of Said Qutb, or even the very prominent recent Muslim scholar Al-Qarzawi, who spoke about the issue of Palestine and Israel. For Al-Qarzawi, he argued that there's no dialogue between Muslims and Jews. The dialogue is dialogues of battle and swords. I'm paraphrasing these terms. So I think that anti-Semitism within Islamist ideology is substantially different from that of secular Muslims' anti-Semitism. Of course, I think one of the ideas that even the author that earlier I quoted, Basim Tibi, says that the secular Arab anti-Semitism was not so much genocidal to the extent that Islamist anti-Semitism is fundamentally genocidal, because, and he argues it's one of the key pillars of Islamism, particularly the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, starting from Bana and then continuing to Said Qutb. So I think that should be distinguished. But now I want to also bring you to somewhere else. We discuss anti-Semitism in Christian Arabs and Islamist Arabs, another part of the world that you're expert of, Afghanistan. And I, time and again, I listen to people when they talk about Taliban, something which is not at all related to Israel and Palestine conflict at this moment, but at both sides of the party, who are those who are pro and anti, I hear certain form of assertions, which one can say it's anti-Semitic. For example, it's argued that the Taliban is, of course, a kind of colonial project, quote unquote, or it's conspiracy theory behind it, where the Jews are there to support the Taliban, or Israel is there to support the Taliban, or other way around. When Ahmad Massoud traveled to Moscow, a kind of fake news leaked where it was stated
You mean
that
Ahmed Massoud, the younger, young Ahmed
the young
Massoud,
Ahmad
Ahmed Shah
Massoud,
Massoud.
a fake news was released that he received support from Israel, and then the entire Taliban propaganda was really anti-Semitic, which he said that this guy is Israeli agent, and his father was the same way. And then the entire community that he belonged to was also pronounced the same. So how do you see, given your long experience with Afghanistan, how do you see that kind of sentiments in Afghanistan, and how do you encounter, whether you encountered or not, with such kind of feelings and thoughts?
Well, I personally encountered it, but only in a very mild forms. And usually, if I had offended someone, then the issue might, then it might become an issue. And then if I reconciled with them, it was no longer an issue. But of course, first of all, there was a Jewish community in Afghanistan for a very long time, since maybe 500 BC or
yeah.
something. Of course, before it was Afghanistan,
before,
there was a Jewish community in Khorasan, you know, which was part of the Silk Road, you know, Bukhara, Herat, Kabul, Balkh, Memana, they all had, even Ghazni, there were Jewish communities. And in addition, there are some Pashtun genealogies that claim that the Pashtuns are descended, they don't say from Jews, but from Bani Israel, which is the word in Arabic. It's the same in Hebrew, it's Bnei Israel, which is the term used in the Bible for the people who followed Moses, members of the tribe of Israel. And the reason for this, you know, according to this, the descendants of King Saul, known as Kish, were exiled and went to
Hor province.
Hor, yes, went to Hor province, you know, and there is a very old Jewish cemetery in Hor. And that at the time they heard of the arrival of Prophet Muhammad, they sent an emissary to Prophet Muhammad, and they accepted Islam directly from him. Now, what I interpret this as meaning, I don't think, I don't believe, there's absolutely no evidence that this actually happened. But what it means is they're claiming that Pashtuns accepted Islam directly from the Prophet, not because they were conquered by Arabs, you see. So it has an important ideological element to it. So there's that kind of philo-Semitism. People have told me that Zahir Shah, for instance, used to say that Jews are our people, and he allowed them to open a synagogue in Kabul and so on and so forth. But at the same time, you know, Afghans were also very sympathetic to the Germans for the same reason that many others were, because Afghanistan's history was a struggle against Britain and Russia.
Yeah.
And Germany was fighting against both Britain and Russia.
Hmm.
So that led to some pro-German feelings, which also led to some spread of some Nazi ideology there. And then, of course, as the Muslim Brotherhood ideology grew, that also that was also imported into Afghanistan. Now, what I see now is it's there, but it's not very deeply rooted on any side. Like you see, the examples you cited are people use it; they try to use it against their enemies. So if you're against the Taliban, you try to say that Israel is behind the Taliban. If you are against Massoud, you say that Israel is behind Massoud.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone really believes these things, you know, or they don't teach these things in schools. Or it's pure political propaganda.
That's right. I think that is exactly because of the long peaceful coexistence and medieval and ancient cities of the region, including the ones that you mentioned, Herat, Bukhara, Samarkand, where Jews were part of the community. And I recall reading one of the early, in 1950s, a scholar called Eric Brower has written an article on the Jews of Afghanistan, an anthropological account, in which he writes, if I quote for you, that not only do Afghan Jews speak a dialect of Persian, but their communities are located in the northwestern region of the kingdom among Tajiks. And he goes on to distinguish Jews of Samarkand, Bukhara, Herat, north of Afghanistan from the rest of the Jews as like there is a quote unquote identity also in our region, which is called Persian Jews. I heard from some Jews in America, which they are not comfortable with the term Persian Jews or Tajik Jews, because Jews are Jews. It's considered, though it's not race, you have written on it, but it's considered that a distinct group of communities, which is not at all American, or it's not.
I'll tell you, one community that has a very distinct existence is the Bukhara'i Jews.
Bukhara'i Jews, which are predominantly Persian speakers, I suppose.
Yes. Now, the Bukhara'i Jews, it doesn't mean Jews only from Bukhara.
Yeah.
It means the Jews from the old Emirate of Bukhara, which was like all of Khorasan.
And so that kind of peaceful coexistence which existed in the region, where people shared happiness, weddings together, and other kind of communal ceremonies, that does not allow people to become anti-Semitic or teach their kids or write in terms of history and other things against a sort of hatred against Jews. Anyway, but let's talk about the last thing that I might also be interested to speak with you is about how can we understand some of the other controversial concepts, probably in American political debates, about who are settler colonialists and who are indigenous. And you have touched upon this in your article, that which is unpublished, which will be soon published, History, Rights and Wrongs about the Jews. And you said, yes, both Jews were, at some point immigrants, but at some other point also they turned to become a settler colonialist. So how do we understand this? History is, of course, complicated, complex, and we should avoid such kind of binary depiction of any kind of community or people. But how shall we navigate this complex history that Jews were also indigenous to the land and in Palestine, but at some point they were expelled two times in their history, and then they returned back. And the way that the Arabs since 1930s and the Peel Commission, which proposed the very first partition and later on United Nations. So that controversy over land remains. So how do we understand these two concepts that you rightly unpack them, and being indigenous or colonialist settler?
I think to understand the way these concepts work, you have to go back to the ideology of nationalism, ethno-nationalism, the way it arose in Europe, which posited some kind of organic link between a nation, a cultural unit, and a territory. It's what is sometimes called blood and soil nationalism. So that a territory belongs to some collective cultural unit. Now, this is not factually true, you know? And it's like, if you see, it's like country, ethnic groups that try to show what their real territories are. They go back in history and find the point of history where their ethnic group controlled the largest amount of territory. You know, so Greater Punjab, okay. Greater Punjab is bigger than Pakistan. It includes most of North India, Afghanistan, you know, maybe Bukhara too, you know, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Greater Germany was like that, you know. So all these greater ethnic projects are incompatible with each other. So they're formulas for hatred and war, and they're based on a kind of mythical idea of indigenousness, like that ethnic groups are homogeneous. Now, if we go to Palestine, of course, the population of Palestine it's not a family or a tribe. It's a group of people who have migrated from different places adopted different religions over many, many thousands of years. And to say that, and to take one identity which happens to exist now and project it back in time to saying that's the eternal real identity of this land, is it's a political project. It's not a fact. You see? So for Jews, this land has a very important religious significance, because their exile from it twice, according to their religious history, was a punishment from God. And in the end of days, the Messiah, the son of David, will come and they will return to the land. And what Zionism did in a way was act that out in a secular way. You know, it was a secular way of bringing the Messiah. So that's their historical memory. But the fact that they have that historical memory doesn't give them a right to take away any land from the people who are actually living there. Right. But on the other hand, the opponents of Zionism say, no, this is all a fiction. The Jews have no attachment to Palestine. This is just made up by the colonialists, which isn't true. The Jews did have an attachment to Palestine, but that doesn't give them any rights to take the land away from other people who are living there. Mm. You see, there are the relationship of identities to territory is some fluid, changes over time. There are overlapping claims, you know, like you're from Herat. So is Herat part of Afghanistan? Is Herat part of Iran? Is Herat part of Khorasan? And the answer is, at different times, Herat was part of all of those things, you know, and all of those things go into the making of the ideology of the identity of today's people of Herat. And to try to just say it's one or the other, you know, would not be true to history.
Sure. So with that said, can we imagine any peaceful resolution and Israel and Palestine, given the current context that the war in Gaza and the military operation of Israel there doesn't seem to be a plan in current Israeli cabinet to leave Gaza militarily and transfer the political administration to a neutral administration, probably to the West Bank, Palestinian Authority, or any other kind of agreement which should emerge eventually between some of the prominent Arab countries. But Biden administration is trying to push that one. But finally, the dispute over land, which is also entangled with history and ideology and identity. And there's a material part of it, that there's a value and identity part of it. It's quite complex. So at this context that we are there, some prominent scholars may argue that there should be an opportunity to finally come to an end of this conflict and lay a kind of political roadmap. What do you think? Do we have an opportunity to finally draw a solution for it or not?
I don't think we have the luxury of doing analysis about whether we have an opportunity to do it or not. We have to try to do it. Whether we have the opportunity to do it or not, we have to try to do it, because the current situation is completely intolerable. Of course, objectively, if you wanted to ask me what is more likely to happen, what is most likely to happen is more horrible things. But I think that it is our responsibility. I'll just say me, I feel there's not much I could do, but I feel it's my responsibility in whatever small ways I can to try to work against that. And I know there are a lot of other people that think that, but the dynamic of the current situation is toward violence and hatred, of course. And the Israeli government, current Israeli government, which is a very right-wing, practically fascist, racist government, their idea of peace is complete domination.
Yeah.
They don't even call it peace, you know. It is complete domination, which, of course, will never work, because those who are dominated will rise up unless you completely exterminate them. But, you know, the most successful extermination project so far in history was the it's hard to say what that is. It was the exterminate. Maybe it was, I was going to say the Nazis against the Jews, but maybe the American settlers against the Native Americans was more was even more effective. And I'm sure there are many other such genocides that we maybe don't even know about. But at any rate, you know, people should not confuse trying to accomplish something with optimism. But we have no choice, in my opinion, but to try to accomplish something. And there, in a way, if the basic principle is somehow or other, all the people that live in that land should have equal rights, as close as you can get to it. You know, nobody has, no country does everyone have absolutely equal rights, not in Afghanistan, not in the United States, just to pick, you know, your country and mine. But as they should at least have some ability to participate in politics and so on. So there are basically two models for how to do that. Each one is two states, one for each people, and the other is one state in which everybody has equal rights.
Which one is feasible? Do you think even some scholars may say now at this moment, even two-state solution may not look feasible, given that?
Yes, both of them look like completely impossible, I would say. But I would say that the two-state solution is maybe slightly less impossible because it has some international support. And it's hard to imagine two states, Israel and Palestine, living in peace with each other, Israel with an Arab minority, Palestine with a Jewish minority. But it's even harder to imagine a state that is 50% Israeli Jews and 50% Muslim and Christian Palestinians. They wouldn't even be able to agree on what to call their country. Or what to teach in any of the schools. So it's an ideal that is attractive, but I just, it's harder to imagine how it would work. But of course, in the current situation, it will take, you know, decades and decades, and it will take strong intervention by the United States and other great powers. And the condition of the United States, remember, the condition the United States is in. The United States is in terrible condition. And it's very politically divided. And now the Democratic Party is very politically divided as a result of this war in Gaza.
Yeah.
So I don't see much leadership coming out of the United States. So I have to be both pessimistic and hopeful at the same time. It's a difficult combination. But I got used to it from working on Afghanistan for many years.
That is understandable. And there are more to talk, of course, and I continue this conversation with you, Barney, but I have to end it here. Truly grateful to your time and interest in this episode. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much, Omar, and thanks you very much for thinking of reaching out to me, and let's continue this in the future.
Sure, of course. And finally, I would like to also thank our listeners. I hope you enjoyed listening to Dr. Barney Truby. Please subscribe to the podcast and make sure to share it with your friends on social media. Looking forward to talking to you and connecting to you in the next episode.
Okay.